I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Cultural historian Yvonne Singh is tall, blonde, and Australian. Little wonder, then, that in the Arab world she's been studying for decades, she stands out, in her words, like a stevedore at a tea party. Despite the discomfort of that distinction, it may have served her well when she set out, uninvited, to discover the views of spiritual leaders not often heard in the West. In her book, Men in Black Dresses, Singh tells the story of her journey from the Grand Sheikh of Islam to the Coptic Christians of Egypt to the Sufi mystics of Syria and back. So here's our question to you. Could you imagine undertaking a similar search for answers to the great mysteries of life? What wisdom would you expect to find from men in black dresses? What would you ask them? And with so many conflicts in the world taking on the shades of holy war, do you see religion as a force for good or just increasing polarization? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Yvonne Singh, author of the new book, Men in Black Dresses, and professor of Islamic studies at Wesley Theological Seminary. Welcome, Yvonne.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. I have to ask first about how you were able to just show up uninvited. It was a little bit like going to the back door of the Vatican and knocking politely and saying, you know, I'd really like to talk to the Pope for a few minutes. Could I sit down and speak with him for an hour? I mean, as you look back, do you wonder, what was I thinking?
Exactly. Even when I was doing it, I started to think, what on earth am I doing here? And even more of a surprise to me was when I had wonderful responses from these wonderful men, so men in black dresses. And I think part of it was the shock of my just turning up and wanting to talk as an ordinary person to these people, as if they were my grandfathers or uncles, and, you know, just wanted them to set me straight on what the hell was going on.
Mm. And why do you think they were willing to see you? I mean, was a large part of it, as you suggest, the novelty? Here you are, a Westerner and a woman, and also someone who literally spoke their language.
A Westerner, no. I don't think I was a novelty as that, and I don't think I was a novelty as a woman. I think it was the combination of having the credentials and wanting to ask questions that they hadn't been asked before, or that, you know, it was for them to take time out and deal with issues and talk about issues that they normally themselves didn't get to face.
Mm. So it was not like a journalist coming in and wanting to talk about politics or current events. You really wanted some deep questions answered.
Yes, yes. And I was like a little rat terrier in a way. I'm sorry to say that. But for each one of them, they had my credentials, so that helped get me in the door. But also, I had spent 2 years doing my doctoral work in the Mosque of Suleiman the Magnificent in Istanbul. So I had spent a couple of years surrounded by holy men, and I was used to their jokes and the rhythm, and I knew how to work with them and to just be patient with them. And so this helped me a lot. This helped me a lot. But yes, it was not being a journalist helped getting in, and not being part of the political scene helped getting in. But once I was there, each one of them just looked directly into me to see if I were sincere or to see whether I were from the CIA or whether I was some California flake. You know, apologies to anyone who's listening, but, you know, they wanted to make sure I was really sincere. And I think they saw that and that I really wanted answers to these questions.
Mm. Now, your first interview was with the Grand Sheikh of Islam in Egypt. And I wonder, if you were to interview him again today, would you ask different questions? And what do you think he would say?
I would ask the same questions. However, I think he would want to ask me questions in return. And his questions would be what I wanted to know: what is going on? And regarding America, and, you know, I think the tables have really turned. Whereas we were once questioning the Middle East about what was going on there, they're now asking, what is America doing in the world? And I'm afraid I can't answer that. And, you know, I was also questioned by a young man who worked with the Grand Sheikh about why doesn't America like us? And I think I would get much more of that now than I did before.
And this was in, what, 99 that you had these
interviews? In 99, I was there.
So yeah. Clearly pre-2001, pre-war in Iraq.
Yes. And things have not improved. And I think that's what is the timelessness of, you know, the questions that I was asking them. You know, since then, you know, I've spoken to people like Jane Goodall, and she is, you know, UN Ambassador for Peace, and she's all over the world all the time. So she's a pretty good person who can tell you what's going on. And she, from the plane, watches the planet deteriorating. She watches the green spaces disappearing as she flies. And this is in the last few years. And also Jan Morris, the wonderful travel writer, has decided she will no longer write because of what she's seeing happen in the world.
Mm.
And I think, you know, this is in the last few years since this time that I was writing. So I think it hasn't gotten better in larger global terms as well as more micro terms.
And were you surprised by how much in tune these holy men were with things like the environment, with globalization, with technology?
Yes. See, it impacts them. We think that these people are out of touch, but they're not. They can watch the whole world from where they are. And now with the, you know, satellite communications, internet, etc., they have access to the entire world. And so they're able to look at the world from an old perspective. And they're all plugged in. With the Coptic Orthodox of youth, he had cell phones and he has confessions by internet. You know, I call him the cyber copt because he thinks that the internet is the wave of the future. It's the open door of the future for the young people of Egypt and the young people of the Middle East and the Christian Copts particularly.
Mm. Now, give us a sense of some of the people that you sought out and why you went to them in particular.
Well, the Grand Sheikh of Islam was someone I had put on the top of my list, never, ever expecting to get inside the door. And that happened within really 48 hours of my arrival. So I thought, oh, it's all over now. I can go home. You know, it doesn't get any better than this because he rarely gives interviews. I mean, he is the spiritual advisor for a billion Sunni Muslims in the world. So, and he leads a university that's 1,000 years old, in, you know, that's been continuous. So after I saw him, I thought, But then I became very, very curious about talking to the old Christian communities of the area. And so I wanted to speak to the head of the Coptic Church, if possible, because the Copts are the direct line from the pharaohs. They consider themselves the sons and the daughters of the pharaohs in Egypt. And so I wanted to hear what their wisdom would be for young generations. And also in Syria, I spoke with the Grand Patriarch of the Assyrian Church, and that goes back to the time of St. Paul. The church is off the street of called a street called Straight, where St. Paul received his revelation. So, and then Sufis, I've always been attracted to Sufis, I have to tell you. And so I went seeking them out to see what their kind of off-the-wall, let's say, wisdom would be. And then my last stop was in the desert of St. Catherine's, because the desert father there, who is a Greek Orthodox archbishop, has been a guardian of that wonderful site, which is where the burning bush was, and also at the base of Mount Moses, where we received our Ten Commandments. So I wanted to see what he thought of the Ten Commandments and what his perspective of the earth. So these were on my wish list. There was one person I didn't get to, I really wanted to, and that was Mata al-Maskin. And he is a wonderful monk or bishop in the deserts of Egypt who's using the technology of the pharaohs to make the desert bloom again. And but I wasn't able to get to him because he was in a security zone. But we did communicate by fax and modern technology.
Hmm. Do you get the sense that some of these holy men, and particularly those with a more moderate worldview, perhaps have been overtaken a bit by events?
Oh, absolutely. And these are the guys who have to guard the home fires while all the extremist events are going on. And they also are under attack. So their life there is very fragile, particularly for the minorities, because there is always a backlash against the Christian minorities by the extremist Muslims under in times of difficulty.
And so how do they walk that tightrope between being spiritual leaders, but also clearly needing to be responsive to the emotions and the grievances of these very separate communities?
Yeah, very, very difficult. With the Christian communities, they are really concentrating on their young people. In Egypt, for example, 60% of the population now is under 18, which is just phenomenal. So they have a real focus, all these leaders have a real focus on the youth, because if these youth end up disaffected, unemployed, etc., they are the ones who are going to go to the right or the left of their faith. With the Christians, there's a much closer community and far less children per family usually, so the community's tighter. But with the Islamic community, there is a real problem in that so many of these young people now, this 60%, is unemployed or going to be unemployed. And they see a lot of this dissatisfaction coming. It's the source of it is the West and the oppression they see of the West. And so it's natural for them to go against the West. How this ties with religion is that someone like the Grand Sheikh Tantawi is in place because of Mubarak, and Mubarak is seen as a tool of the West and of oppression. So therefore the Grand Sheikh has to be very, very careful. If he speaks out, then he will lose his position and somebody else will be put in place. And if he doesn't speak out, then the young radicals who are just, you know, fiery to have some action, they're going to leave the moderate center and go towards the extremists. So they're in a very, very tight position. Some people wish that the religious leaders would speak out, but they really can't.
Well, I was going to say, do you find that the leaders who don't get into the political arena are still being listened to?
Yes, they are, by their own, yes. They're seen as a real source of quiet sustenance for the communities. And these Christian communities in particular know they have to survive. And they have been through so much upheaval for, you know, 2,000 years almost. So they are survivors, and they will survive. And they also, the minority communities, particularly the Coptic community, also wants to make sure that young Muslims and young Christians are reading off the same page. And so they have a lot of not interfaith dialogue, they don't call it that, but they bring together their young people to make sure that they're learning about the media and what's going on in the world. And so they're trying to keep the doors open on both sides. But it's a very, very difficult situation.
And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We are speaking this hour with cultural historian Yvonne Singh about the men in black dresses of the Middle East. Do you see a place for religion above politics? And if you could meet with the leaders of the Coptic Christians or the Grand Sheikh of Islam, what would you ask him? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. And we're talking this hour with author Yvonne Singh about her travels and talks with the men she calls the wisdom makers of the Middle East. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Yvonne, let me ask you to put us in your chair. If you could pick one of these spiritual leaders that you spoke with and spent some time with, what did you say to them? What did they say to you? What really lingers in your mind about one of those conversations?
I have two favorites. They're all, but the Grand Sheikh of Islam, Sheikh Tantawi, really impressed me so much, because I had asked him about, I wanted to ask him about the state of us as the humans on the planet, as caretakers of the planet, not only towards the planet and the environment, but towards each other. And I had expected some long homily, and what he said, really, he turned to the Quran, and he said that, you know, God has created us from the earth of the planet and we'll return to it. But he said, really, we've made a mess of the place, and that our investment in the planet is not only physical, it's also spiritual. And he said that at the end, you know, the time that I was there, at the end of the last century, and it really applies to today, that we're living in a kind of jungle where the strong eat the weak and there's no mercy and justice. And he really spoke about diversity and respecting diversity of others and teaching children. And this was the very soft spot that surprised me with him especially. I hadn't expected for him to be such a grandfatherly person. And he said, you know, to teach young people to respect differences, to help those who are weak. And this really stuck with me. But when I was in Damascus and I met with the patriarch of the Assyriac Church, and he is charged with keeping the word of Christ alive, and that is the language, and that's Aramaic. And, you know, Aramaic's very much in the news now because of Mel Gibson's The Passion, etc., and which I think is an unfortunate way to keep it alive. But he's charged with keeping the word alive because he says that when the word in which the word spoke disappears, then we will lose our wisdom. And so, but I was talking to him in the cathedral, and he is a very Santa Claus-like looking man with a white beard and a red velour outfit with fur on it and gold, et cetera, et cetera. And he's sitting on what we would describe as a throne, but it's really just a very big gilt chair. And I said to him, I was doing a Barbara Walters kind of routine at this point, and I said to him, so tell me what peace looks like to you. Describe peace to me. And suddenly he just slumped from his very official position, and he says, peace, you ask me. Peace looks like a very old man, a tired old man. And there was such feeling in what he said. You could just feel the, you know, the centuries, the millennia of struggle that has gone through his church and his faith. So these were just two examples of the types of conversations that we had that were unexpected.
That was a lovely moment. I do remember it well. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Scott now. We want to hear from Jacksonville, North Carolina. Scott, what's on your mind?
Well, first of all, I so envy your guests. I wish I could have been a little mite on her shoulder while she was saying that. That sounded wonderful. Well, to hear your last comment about the sheikh, I believe it was, that slumped when you mentioned the word peace, my own life, I've certainly sought out a lot. I'm a Christian, and I pray that I'm a peaceful and joyful one. And I think that's my study has certainly taught me that the great men and women of the world and religions have been all one commonality is peace and joy and love. And of course, they all slump, and we all slump when we see what goes on. My comment is that I can hardly believe that the black robed men would, when they look at America, that I can almost understand their almost unpeaceful like notion that of us being the great Satan, in the sense that it's our consumption, our economic model. It demands that we continue to sell the world on our economic system, that we consume and that we sell it to the rest of the world. And I can't help but believe where there's countries where the men of spiritual background are continued to be strong advisors, it's going to be a very difficult sell because they see what it does to people and see what it's done to our nation. And I just can't imagine that they would. I mean, they're not stupid either. They have needs. They need to have, you know, provide for their people. But I can't help but believe they would see our level of consumption as being as very deadly to their people.
And they are concerned about this. And this is why they're trying to teach young people that consumption and capitalism, if we could put it that way, you know, the striving for more is not necessarily positive. So they teach their young people that to look and study everything that there is out there. And based on your own community and upbringing, which is, you know, strong and enforced, that then you should choose what's best. And they there's very much conflict. There's a lot of conflict about the multiple identities that have been offered from the West. You know, when we talk about democracy, for example, democracy, unfortunately, is tied with a way of life. And that way of life means pursuing money in a way that and leaving the family behind. And this flies in the face of values of the region.
Mm. Scott, thank you for the call. And Yvonne, pursuing that point just a bit, do you think they view the West with anger or with sadness?
The West, America.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's very difficult because the people of the Middle East love America. As soon as you start talking to them, do you know my cousin in Detroit? Do you know my aunt in so-and-so? Everybody wants to come here. It's the land of opportunity. They see opportunity. But at the same time, they are so confused with the kinds of values that we seem to be exporting as well. So they feel that in a way that Americans are stepping back from their own spiritual values in which the country was founded, and that in a way that they have lost their spiritual core or their center.
Hmm. I was also struck in the book about how much of your journey was prompted by certain, I guess we have to say, intuitive feelings. You know, go
yes.
here, don't go there. Why does this place seem to be drawing me?
Yes.
Why is this person significant when
mm-hmm.
you just glance at them once and you have mm-hmm. a feeling about them? Had you been in the habit of listening to those kinds of intuitive prompts before you set out on this journey?
No, I had been in the habit of getting rid of those intuitive prompts because training as an academic, and, you know, I trained at the University of Chicago in a very rigorous background in the Oriental Institute, and so you're trained to get rid of your intuitions and feelings. And so I, in a way, I call it emotion erasure in a way. And so what happened when I was back in the Middle East, that I put this on hold. I put my brain on hold for a while. And I started to listen to my emotion, my feeling, my senses, which all these leaders kept telling me to do. And if you remember from the book, one of the Sufi poet, when I finally get to meet him in the mountains of Damascus, and he has been faxed my resume and all my honors and awards, and he's not impressed. And he says to me, he's holding all these things there, he's holding this, and he says, I'm impressed with what I see, but where on this paper is there room for your heart and your family? And my response inside is that, but this is my heart. My work is my heart. And academics don't have families. We're not allowed to have families. And so this was their challenge, each one of them, their challenge for me is, have you lost your heart in order to pursue the cult of your head?
Exactly. That's something that each person wanted to know about. Not how
yes.
smart are you, but what's the condition of your heart?
And this is their reflection also on the West as well, is that they think that we have lost our heart and that we have become so caught up in our head and in the dogma of our head that we've lost the original sense of what words meant or what directions meant. For example, the Ten Commandments that the Archbishop in the desert says, the Desert Father says, you know, the Ten Commandments were fine, but they don't go far enough. Action is what you need, not words. And so they feel this, a lot of these people feel this about the West, that we call a committee meeting when we should be taking care of, you know, world poverty or AIDS or something, instead of acting from our hearts.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. We're going now to Cary, North Carolina. Greg's on the line. Hello, Greg, and welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, just great.
I just had two quick questions for you. I'm interested in
if you questioned the Grand Ayatollah about, he spoke to you about peace and tolerance. Did you ask him about the state of the, you know, the current Arab world, where there seems to be teaching in the madrasas of, you know, the hatred of America and the great state? Did you have a discussion with him about that?
For one thing, he's not an Ayatollah. Ayatollah's Shia. He's Sunni, so he's a Grand Mufti.
An imam?
He's a head imam, let's put it that way. And unlike the Ayatollahs, he doesn't have the political clout, let's say, that the Shia have. But no, we did not talk about what's going on in the Arab world, because it was almost a tacit agreement that we would not talk about politics, because everyone talks about politics, and I wanted to talk about some other things. But underneath it all, politics, you know, politics is attached to everything. You can't get away from it. But no, we did not talk openly, or we did not talk, we did not address the teaching in the madrasas.
And just
go ahead.
I had one other quick question. I've just been fascinated by the monastery at St. Catherine's?
Yes, yes.
Monastery. Are they still finding valuable manuscripts that are in St. Catherine's, and are they protecting all those precious resources there?
Yes, and I think they're coming to the world attention. In fact, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there's a wonderful show on at the moment that has some of those precious materials from the Sinai, from the monastery. So if you can get up there to see it, please do. In fact, the Archbishop from the desert was there to help open it, the show, which opened last month. But yes, they are. One of the most wonderful documents there that most people don't know about is a piece, however, that was given by the early caliphs, Islamic caliphs, in the time, in the 7th century. Some of them may have been later, but it's one of them is a document that gives protection to the holy men of the monastery when the Islamic conquests were going on, because these were considered people of God and they were not to be touched. So that's also there.
Greg, appreciate the phone call. Yvonne, let me ask you about the misconceptions go both ways, I think
yes.
It's fair to say. What do people in the West really not understand about Islam?
Oh, Islam. I'm pausing. I'm watching the clock go around as you say that, because there's so much. And one of the things, you know, we all talk about the great monotheism. Islam is not one Islam, for one thing. But Islam, in its pure sense, is a very community-oriented religion, and it's based on building community and keeping community together. I think that's the greatest thing that the greatest point that non-Muslims should take out of Islam.
And what do you think the major lesson might be taken by the West from the East about family and continuity and community?
Very, very strong. And I think part of the rebellion, we can, if you want to call it that, against the West, is that they see that the values that are being brought to these areas are breaking up families and are aimed at breaking up communities. And this is very, very difficult for them. I can give you one example of how the cops, for example, are trying to work with this issue. In the Middle East, there's a value that young people never turn their back on an elder or a parent, just physically, because it is symbolic of turning your back on them, period, in old age, and turning your back on their wisdom and what they have to say. Now, what happens physically when you put a young person in front of a computer and they get on the internet is their back is towards their families. And so these families are going through the shock of looking at the back of their children, the children that they've raised, and knowing that their children are accessing the outside world and are no longer keeping eye contact with their own families. And so the challenge, you know, for these people, just as it is for the challenge of parents in Indiana or Ohio, etc., is how do you reinforce the values in children before they're set loose into the wide world, whether it's by giving them the keys to the car or putting them on the internet where they have access to people that their parents can't filter. So, yes, so this, above all, is the question that's in the minds of people in the Middle East, is how do we protect our young people? How do we keep our communities together? We don't want them broken up. And for the minority communities, they especially don't want their communities broken up. One of the other things that I found from these elders is that they're very much interested in keeping the communities alive in the United States, that is, the immigrant communities. But the communities here, they tell them that, you know, when they have multiple identities, that first of all, your allegiance is to the new place that you are in and God, but the new place that you are in rather than the old place that you are in. And so in an Orthodox church, when the Orthodox pray here, the Arabs who have migrated, they pray for the welfare of the United States and the American president, and that's where their allegiance lies. And I think this is very interesting, still the community staying together against all odds.
That's such a fascinating point you make about turning your back literally on the family and exposing yourself to this wider world, because anyone who's ever seen a young person sitting at a computer screen surfing the net, they have no idea what's going on in the room behind them.
Yes, yes. And it's like, show me your face, please. Show me your face. And the world is seeing the face, not the parents anymore. So the cybercopt especially is dealing with this because, you know, we talked about pornography on the internet and how, you know, this leads to not only the wandering of minds, but also adventure outside of the community. And how do you deal with that? So these are big questions for those faith communities.
They are indeed. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm talking this hour with Yvonne Singh about the role of religion in the Middle East. Can you imagine a place for faith removed from politics? And with so many conflicts in the world taking on the shades of holy war, do you see religion as a polarizer or the ultimate force for good? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. We invite you to join us. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. We're talking this hour about the conflict between modernism and mysticism with cultural historian Yvonne Singh. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go now to our phone lines to Toronto, Canada. Anthony's on the line. Hello, Anthony, and welcome.
Hello, Yvonne. Hi.
Hello, Anthony.
The patriarch in Damascus is my great uncle, by the way.
Oh, bravo!
Isn't that something?
I want wonderful to present man. A wonderful man.
Yes, yes. I want to present you two concepts. First, did you find these spiritual leaders, if you want to call them that, to be quite candid? I would imagine the way you're coming across, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I found them quite candid on the questions that I asked them. In fact, your uncle was very candid. Towards the end of the interview, I asked him what would happen if we discovered life in outer space. And, you know, just thinking about these, how we deal with the alien. And he slapped his knee and he said, I'll teach them Aramaic. So very, very candid in that way.
Yeah, you see, the religion there, as you could, as you found out, if you go to the churches and mosques, you don't see many statues, because religion and the concept of Christianity or Islam or what have you is really is a concept. It's an abstract rather than you know, as you notice also, people do not point to the scripture all the time.
Yes,
it's an ideology.
Yes,
do you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is what they talked about, was living the life.
Right. And people over there, they're frustrated with the West, especially in America, because in America, the Christians always point to the scripture and verse and that. And that's, I mean, the scripture, even in the Middle East, they realize it has been revised and translated and what have you. Meanwhile, in America, like, oh, wow, it's the scripture, so I have to go by it. Anyway, if you want to comment on that, fine. Otherwise, I have another question for you.
Well, you've pointed to a very interesting trend that's taking place, and actually someone during my trip pointed this out to me while I was there. I asked him how he foresaw, what direction did he see religion going in the future, and he said experiential. That is, each of us having our own experience with God and not with the Word. That is the book, the Scripture. And in the United States, we're finding that the fastest growing groups are the Orthodox groups, and not because of birth rate, but because of conversion from people who are really becoming tired of the Protestant churches, let's say, where a lot of the mystery has been removed. And so a lot of young people in particular are turning to the Orthodox churches to return to that mystery, the old mystery and the symbolism and just the emotion. And at the same time, the charismatic churches here are growing because people want that emotional experience away from
and the Orthodox Church is not aggressive in converting people. The other thing I want to ask you, if hypothetically you were to have a similar interview, let's say, with people in America, do you think they'll be as candid with you, or they insist on speaking to you in sound bites. I know the answer, obviously.
Yes, more sound bites. But I do believe that there are spiritual men and women throughout the United States to whom I could speak who would not speak in sound bites. And they would be people in monasteries, on reservations, you know, more out of the mainstream cathedral power elite.
Anthony, thanks very much for the call and the questions. And Yvonne, a bit more on that thought about the differing roles of religious leaders in the West and the East.
Yes, the religious leaders in the East have been, they're part of a continuing community that has been there for so long and that is based on experience and memory. There's a very strong memory that's passed on. And the streets down which you walk are tied to memory. Foods are tied to memory. Landmarks are tied to memory. So there's a very, very strong sensory memory within the churches and contained within the leaders. Also, the leaders over there, if I speak about the Orthodox, they're very much, the leaders are broken into two groups, those who become bishops, and that is those who pursue the mystical experience, and those who become priests, and that is they are the fathers, literally, of the community, and they're fathers in a way they have to marry so that they will know the whole dynamic of the family and be able to be a father for an entire community. So this is another way in which those communities are slightly different than most of our communities here. The other thing is that the leaders, and in this case I'm speaking of the experience of the Grand Sheikh Tantawi, even though he officially or unofficially has the position equal to the Pope, we could say, every Muslim still has access to him. They can go to his office and ask him for his opinion or his judgment on something in their lives. And so when I was there getting the interviews, the pre-interview, let's say, I was there with two other women and several men, but the women, I felt very insulted that I was going to be stuck with the women, of course, and this was my training that I wanted to be with the men. And I was about to lose an opportunity because what I found out was the power of these women, the social power of these women. One was a washerwoman who was lobbying for a position for her daughter in the new mosque that was about to be built. And another was a female student who had taken the imam, the Grand Sheikh, as a professor and wanted him to give her a good recommendation for the next exam. So these are the types, this is the type of access that the community has to their religious leader. And it's part of their understanding, their social understanding. And I don't think it's the same here. The leaders here have become more bureaucrats.
I'm glad you told that story because it is one of my favorite moments from the book. We want to go to Ashland now, Ashland, Massachusetts. Imran is on the phone.
Hi, Professor. Yes. You know, I wanted to ask if you had the opportunity to ask the question about gender roles, because I think I'm a Muslim. I've been born and raised in the West, and my observation increasingly is that when you look at the fundamental tensions between the Middle East and the Muslim world in general with the West, a lot of it kind of boils down to gender roles and the roles of women in society. You raised the issue of pornography, and you know, that's something that really is abrasive to, I think, Muslim sensibilities. Yet,
yes.
You know, this is something that we say is part of, you know, free speech in
yes.
in the West. And so, I've even kind of come down to on the decision that really, even the war on terrorism is really kind of ancillary to the fundamental role of values that's kind of at pull between East and West. I just want to know if you raised that issue.
I didn't raise that issue, but it's one I've been thinking about a lot lately. That what we're really talking about is values, is the push and pull of values between the areas, the two sides and the two areas. Now, gender roles are very, very important. And it's something that people can rally around with a lot of good reason. And unfortunately, women have are in the center of a huge tug of war between old society or village society also and new society. And they have become a symbol of values. And it's not that this has not happened in other societies, even in Western society. This has been something, and the emancipation of women in the West is fairly recent in history. I mean, we go through waves of this. But yes, I believe that this whole concept of putting woman at the center and putting gender at the center of the argument, we can, however, get lost in this question. If you talk to a lot of women in Muslim countries or other countries, they will say, you know, this argument is not about the headscarf or the hijab. The argument is really about human rights. And when I spoke to men in Egypt, or they spoke to me, they would call it the woman thing. They would say, doesn't the West understand that it's about human rights? It's men's rights as well. So that's their perspective on this whole question of gender. And I think it's a very strong question that won't go away.
Imran, thanks for the call. And let me put a personal question to you, Yvonne, about that, because you dressed very conservatively when you were there. Several times you put on a headscarf.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that's such a symbolic act. I wonder
yes.
if it made you feel differently about yourself in that moment.
Yes, it did. When I worked in the mosque in Istanbul, I never wore a headscarf. I made it, you know, my thing that I would never wear a headscarf. And when I went to interview the Grand Sheikh of Islam, when I went for the pre-interview, I didn't wear a headscarf because I didn't think I was going to see him. And that was my thinking. But also other women in the mosque, in the grand office, were not wearing headscarves either. So there was very much an openness, and I could choose to wear the headscarf. And I wore it. I didn't have to, and I thought about this later, and my cheeks were burning. Why did I put the headscarf on? I kind of wimped out, to be honest, because I didn't want anything to stand in the way of my getting an interview. So if the headscarf was going to be a problem with him, I didn't want it to be. But when I first saw him, I wasn't wearing it. And when I came back the next day and I was wearing it, he was taken aback.
In what way? Just wasn't expecting you to show up
yes,
with one?
Yes, that I had put one on. And it was really out of respect for him, such that if you went to see the Pope, you would put one on. But I struggled. I literally struggled with this. When I went to the mosque of Ibn al-Arabi in Damascus, I wore a headscarf because that's a sign of respect. I did not wear one in the streets. I didn't have to. Because society there is fairly open. But what's happened since 9/11 is that women have started wearing the headscarf as a sign against the United States, signaling their disapproval with the United States. So they also have picked up the headscarf as a political symbol. And I think this is very interesting.
All right, so we have time for one more call. Mm-hmm. We want to try to get in before our time's up from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Andrew's on the line. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew.
I had a question about the changing role in religion. And
yeah.
basically, in many countries, especially in the West, we see a trend towards secularization. And I was wondering about, well, like, you go back a millennia or two, and religion used to fill the role of politics, even entertainment. It was a staple of society. And it's starting to lose that effect. And I was wondering if the religious leaders you spoke to, how aware of this trend they were, if they thought this was going to be a downfall of humanity, or if they saw it as unrelated to the spiritual realm in which they really find value.
You mean religion stretching out into the rest of daily life, or just being something that you do on Sunday for an hour? That kind of.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anthony said, from Canada, in those areas, religion is part of walking down the street. It's not confined to reading the word at specific times of the week, or reading a word that's been translated and mistranslated several times. So they see that that the church is not playing a large role in the United States as a social institution, and I think that that's something that they had pointed out to me. I'm just going back over my mental notes. They had pointed out that there was a loss of cohesion because the church was not playing a social role in the lives of people,
Yvonne,
and a unifying role.
Sorry, we just have a moment or so left, mm-hmm. but I can't let you go without asking. You've been in touch with some of these folks since then.
Yes.
Do you find them more or less optimistic about the future?
We usually don't talk about the future, but I hesitate to put optimism in the mouths of these people, because the messages that they did give me were glass half empty. And that is that we're at a time where we are making decisions for our future that are really going to impact the future in ways that it can transform for the negative.
Mm. Well, Yvonne, we thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
Thank you.
Yvonne Singh is author of Men in Black Dresses, A Quest for the Future Among Wisdom Makers of the Middle East. She's also professor of Islamic studies at Wesley Theological Seminary. You can continue the conversation in our online forums at theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR.